Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, as the genocide against Palestinians in Gaza and increasing attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank continues, an online event was held on March 10th, 2024. The program uplifted the stories and voices of women living in Palestine. They participated in the event that marked International Women's Day, entitled We Stand With Palestinian Women, Children, and Their Families Against the Israel-U.S. Genocide, Including Bombing and Starvation. The event was called by the Global Women's Strike and Women of Color in the Global Women's Strike. We were joined by a wide-ranging planning group that brought women and men across movements, standing in solidarity with and offering practical support via the Middle East Children's Alliance. We worked directly with Deborah Ager of Mecca in organizing the event. In addition to the planning group, sponsoring organizations included Alexandria House, the Reverend Annie Chambers, Black Alliance for Just Immigration, Black Lives Matter LA, Every Mother is a Working Mother Network, Haiti Action Committee, Indigenous Environmental Network, International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, Katia Stitt, Program Director of Pacifica Radio's WPFW, La Resistencia out of Tacoma, Washington, the Long Beach Area Peace Network, Los Angeles Baby Cooperative, Military Families Speak Out, Movement for Family Power, Orange County Peace Coalition, Payday Men's Network, Peace, Justice, Sustainability Now, Pete White, founder of the LA Community Action Network, Robin D.G. Kelly, San Pedro Neighbors for Peace and Justice, Social Welfare Action Alliance, Social Workers Ending Poverty Together, U.S. Prostitutes Collective, Veterans for Peace Chapter 110, Veterans for Peace Los Angeles, We Stand Up for All Baltimore, Maryland, Welfare Warriors, Women's March Foundation Los Angeles. The voices of Palestinian women are rarely heard, so we're glad to bring you their voices on today's program. Now, we live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. Gaza's health ministry says 93 Palestinians have been killed in the last 24 hours, inching the death toll closer to 32,000, now 31,819. Among the dead, at least 15 in the southern city of Rafah, where Israel's planning a ground invasion, though that's already underway. And in the north, Israel says it's killed 50 militants at the Al-Shifa hospital after forces raided it and killed a senior Hamas operative, Faik Mabou, according to Israeli forces. Israel's military says it's killed more than 13,000 militants without providing evidence in Gaza. Meanwhile, the White House says President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke by phone Monday about the ongoing war in Gaza and the expected Israeli ground operation into Rafah. Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, said Biden told Netanyahu he's wary of a Rafah offensive.
Our position is that Hamas should not be allowed a safe haven in Rafah or anywhere else. But a major ground operation there would be a mistake. It would lead to more innocent civilian deaths, worsen the already dire humanitarian crisis, deepen the anarchy in Gaza, and further isolate Israel internationally.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will send a team of Israeli officials to Washington to discuss with the Biden administration its Rafah operation. Dozens of U.S. citizens have been evacuated from Haiti on a State Department charter flight, with more potentially on the horizon as the Caribbean nation remains paralyzed by escalating gang violence. Meanwhile, aid groups say almost 1.5 million Haitians are on the verge of famine, and more than 4 million require food aid, sometimes eating only once a day or not at all, according to the World Food Program. Days after Russia's President Vladimir Putin threatened a nuclear war, United Nations General Secretary Antonio Guterres spoke out against the use of nuclear weapons. Monday, The same day Putin threatened a World War III after winning re-election.
States possessing nuclear weapons are absent from the table of dialogue. There is one path, and one path only, that will vanquish this senseless and suicidal shadow once and for all. We need disarmament now. Nuclear weapon states must urgently agree that none of them will be the first to use nuclear weapons. As a matter of fact, none should use them in any circumstances. We need reduction in the number of nuclear weapons. This reduction must be led by the holders of the largest nuclear arsenals, the United States and the Russian Federation, who must find a way back to the negotiations table.
Guterres urged the two countries to recommit to the new START Strategic Arms Reductions Treaty that Russia pulled out of last year amidst U.S. support for Ukraine. Officials say a Russian border region plans to evacuate 9,000 children because it's being continuously shelled from the Ukrainian side. Kiev's forces have been increasingly striking at targets behind the front line. Meanwhile, Russia's defense ministry said it's captured the village of Orlivka in Ukraine's Donetsk region. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, in a social media post today, said since the beginning of March, Russia has launched 130 missiles, more than 320 Shahed drones, and nearly 900 aerial bombs on targets in Ukraine. Zelensky made an appeal for more weapons from Ukraine's allies. In the U.S., the Supreme Court has refused to halt a prison sentence for former Trump White House official Peter Navarro as he appeals his contempt of Congress conviction. Navarro is due to report today to a federal prison for a four-month sentence after being found guilty of misdemeanor charges for refusing to cooperate with a congressional investigation into the deadly January 6, 2021 Capitol attack. Navarro's maintained he couldn't cooperate with the committee because former President Donald Trump had invoked executive privilege. Lower courts have rejected that argument, finding Navarro couldn't prove Trump had actually invoked it. Navarro is set to be the first White House official to be imprisoned. President Biden signed an executive order expanding government research into women's health Monday. It does this by strengthening data collection and providing better funding opportunities for biomedical research, including menopause. Biden said women make up half the population, but their health is underfunded and understudied. It wasn't until the 1990s that the federal government mandated women be included in federally funded medical studies. But most of medical history, scientific study, was based almost entirely on men. Donald Trump's lawyers told a New York appellate court on Monday it's impossible for him to post a bond covering the full amount of a $454 million civil fraud judgment against him while he appeals. If Trump cannot post bond by Monday, New York Attorney General Letitia James can begin to seize his assets. Trump and his top executives, including his sons Eric and Donald Trump Jr., were found guilty of scheming for years to deceive banks and insurers by inflating Trump's wealth on financial statements used to secure loans and make deals. I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Those were our news headlines, and we're now going to go directly to a one-hour special of women speaking out from Palestine. I served as MC of the event, and for full disclosure, a part of Women of Color in the Global Women's Strike, one of the organizers that called the event. Let's go to that program right now.
Hello, welcome, and thank you for joining us today. I'm Phoebe Jones with the Global Women's Strike, who, with Women of Color in the Global Women's Strike, have called for this event. And we are joined in this call by 29 sponsoring organizations, which is providing immediate aid to children and families in Gaza who face bombing, starvation, displacement, and genocide. We are joined by our sisters in the UK, Ireland, and Thailand, who have been supporting this fundraiser. This event is part of International Women's Day activities to stand with Palestinian women and children who are paying the highest price in this genocide. Women and children are 70% of those who are killed. As mothers, as grandmothers, as women who are the primary caregivers in every society, we cannot bear to witness this slaughter. All children are our children. Palestinian children are our children. This event is not only to hear from those on the ground about the devastation and what they're trying to do to alleviate it, but also for each of us to pledge to do all we can, financially and in other ways, to support MECCA's efforts to tackle starvation and prevent deaths. Aaron Bushnell, who set himself on fire outside the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., said, "Many of us like to ask ourselves, what would I do if I was alive during slavery or the Jim Crow South or apartheid? What would I do if my country was committing genocide?" The answer is, you're doing it right now.
I would now like to introduce our first speaker, Josie Shields Stromness, who is the program director for the Middle East Children's Alliance. She lives in Bethlehem with her husband and two children. Josie, I think you're going to start, introduce a video clip, and then we will be hearing more from Josie as she gives her presentation. Josie, thank you. And welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Margaret. Thank you, everyone, for inviting us to speak today and joining us to hear about what's happening in Gaza. Unfortunately, our colleagues in Gaza who are living under this genocide right now are not able to be with us live. So we were able to get a video. It's now more than a month old, but just so you can get some images and hear the voices of our colleagues and our partners in Gaza who are doing such critical work.
We're still here, despite everything, as we have been able to reach about 500,000 people so far and meet some of their basic needs of blankets, water, hygiene kits, warm clothes, and food supplies. We started working since the second day of the war, and we are still working until now. We work in very tragic conditions, including the continuous and random bombing, the communications and internet cut off, the destruction of air infrastructure, as most of the main roads were bombed and destroyed. Also, Gaza Strip ran out of fuel, so we are struggling to provide cars for transportation. Everything that happens here undermines our ability to work and forces us to stop working. But we are still trying in every way to continue our work, and I believe that we have no other choice. We must keep doing our best and not allow ourselves to collapse like everything around us. We were able to form community committees of 100 volunteers in different areas in Gaza Strip so that we could reach the largest number of people in the face of this catastrophic situation. Everyone has become very exhausted with our volunteers, partners, or MECCA team, as the people's need is greater than our capacity. Not to mention our suffering in daily life in our homes. Each home now has at least 80 people.
So that was just a little picture from Gaza of what the work is that's going on with MECCA and our partners and the conditions that they are working under. I wanted to start with a little bit of information about Gaza. My presentation is really just going to focus on the work, though. So here is a map of Gaza. I'm going to be talking about these different areas, north of Gaza and Gaza, Deir Bala, Khan Yunis, and Rafah. In this map, you can see all of these crossings that are closed, that Israel is not allowing anyone or any goods to come in through. The only open crossings right now are all the way in the south in Rafah. There are 2.3 million people living crowded together in Gaza, and they have been living under a brutal siege for 17 years. So that's a little bit of background. Currently, the statistics of the ongoing genocide is that over 30,000 people have been killed in Gaza, more than 12,000 children. The number of injured people has reached over 70,000. And about 85% of the population has been internally displaced. They are displaced, and many of them have no homes to go back to. So they might be living in tents, but it's not just until they can get back to where their homes were. Many of them, their homes are completely destroyed and uninhabitable. So this crisis is today, but it's also unbelievable, unprecedented devastation of every sector in Gaza. You know, that is about the housing units damaged, but the damage to universities, to schools, to the water network, to cultural institutions, to roads, really every aspect of life in Gaza has been targeted. One of the big issues we're working on right now is that Gaza has also been forced into a famine with these genocidal attacks from the land, air, and sea, combined with this very tight blockade of Gaza. We are now seeing people start to die of starvation and dehydration in Gaza, 25 confirmed cases, and everyone believes it's actually much higher. Those are the only reported cases. In the north of Gaza, as you saw in the map, the only crossings that are able to receive any goods right now are in southern Gaza. And Israel has cut off northern Gaza, controls the only roads that lead to the north. And so there's a real restriction on the entry of food, as well as other aid, medicine, fuel, teams to go in and repair damaged water wells, all of this in the north. And this is a collective punishment for the people who stayed in the north. Currently in Gaza, 9 out of 10 people are food insecure. So this is unprecedented on every level. And it's not, you know, a famine that came out of nowhere. It is a human-made crisis. It is a deliberate part and parcel of the genocide in Gaza. That is kind of the background in which the Middle East Children's Alliance is working. We have started our work in Gaza actually for 35 years. So we have a strong network. We have local staff in Gaza who are there, you know, working hard year round, as well as community organizations that are the backbone of our work. And when the attacks started in Gaza, we immediately mobilized. You know, we have had experience of working through Israeli attacks in previous years. And so we immediately reached out to our partners and began preparing our emergency response. We have been working with 10 community-based organizations in Gaza to distribute food parcels. We have now reached, you know, you saw in the video that we'd reached about an estimated 500,000. Now we've been able to continue working and reach about 884,000 people with food parcels. And we focus on, you know, whatever we can get locally, whatever we are able to receive from our partner organizations, and also always buying produce from local farmers as a way to support their steadfastness and them to continue using their lands. We've also distributed another 187,000 meals to families through ready-to-eat kits from our partner, the World Central Kitchen. And this is a photo of our colleague Wafa, who you saw in the video, with one of the food parcels and hygiene kits that we put together in Gaza. Here's some of our staff and partners out in the field. You can see how they are actually working and measuring out all of the bulk foods to pack them into food parcels. Then we have the fresh produce also. Another initiative that we've started in Gaza has been opening community kitchens to provide hot meals. These meals are, you know, an important nutritional value, but also just comfort for families who are living in tents now for months and months. So we have 4 community kitchens running in southern Gaza, and they provide 4,000 hot meals every day. One of our kitchens actually was destroyed by Israeli tanks and bulldozers, but I'm very happy to say that new equipment has arrived in Gaza and it will be up and running again soon. So this number will increase. And the community kitchens are cooking every day. They are, you know, a really beautiful effort from chefs. Some of them are trained chefs. Some of them are just, you know, people who are living in tents and coming together and making meals together. In northern Gaza, where we are not able to send any aid because you need to get permission from Israel to reach there, we have been able to work with a kitchen to provide some hot meals to families, but we don't have any ongoing efforts. We have also been distributing hygiene kits with soap, shampoo, wet wipes, diapers, and women's sanitary supplies. I am sorry to say that those supplies are almost completely out in Gaza. In February, we managed to scour the markets in different cities, and our partners pulled together enough things to make hygiene kits for 3,000 families. But since that time, we have not been able to find these essential supplies. So the only way is to get this aid from outside of Gaza. The local market is completely tapped. Here are some of our volunteers and partners working on packing up these critical hygiene supplies. Some of the other aid we've been able to provide is warm clothes for children and blankets. Also plastic sheeting to cover homes that have broken windows, that have been partially destroyed in airstrikes. And so, you know, the roofs are damaged and they need cover. This is something that we do actually in Gaza every year. When winter hits, the infrastructure in Gaza after 17 years of siege is very damaged. And so when there's heavy rains, there's always flooding. And due to many years of relentless Israeli attacks, there are a lot of homes that have damaged roofs or have just, you know, corrugated iron roofs that don't keep them dry in the winter. And so we always have a winter response in Gaza, trying to help families stay warm and dry. But this year, of course, the challenges are insurmountable. You know, anything that anyone is doing in Gaza right now is not meeting the needs of the community. But we can't let that stop us from trying. I mean, our staff and our partners are out there every day doing what they can, trying to, you know, find things that people need and get them to them. Another area that we've been working on actually for 15 years is clean water. We started the Maya Project in 2009 in response to the water pollution in Gaza. About 97% of water in Gaza is polluted and unfit for human consumption. So we began this project in response to the request of children in Gaza who had a vote in their school and decided what they most wanted for their school was to have clean drinking water. And so we built a water purification unit in that school and have continued ever since to continue building these small, decentralized water purification units in different schools, kindergartens, and community centers throughout Gaza. Many of these, we assume, have been damaged and destroyed in the Israeli attacks. A lot of them are in areas where the entire community fled looking for safety. And so no one has been back to check on their homes, their lands, or these water units. But some of the units are still in areas where people are living in Gaza and continue to provide clean water at this time. We've also been buying water from large water purification units and bringing them in trucks to where there are families in need of clean drinking water. And just recently, we have two new projects that we were able to do. We bought two water purification units, Maya units, we call it. Maya means water in Arabic. And we just installed them in Mawasi, which is an area on the, sorry, I'm never iterated with western edge of Khan Yunis. So as the city of Khan Yunis was very severely attacked and many areas, people were forced to flee from. A lot of tens of thousands of people are now congregated along the edge in this area called Mawasi that has very little infrastructure. It had almost no population before all of these tens of thousands of families fled. So we were able to install two water purification units that run on solar energy and are providing clean drinking water for the families in that area every day. And in Shati Camp, which is in Gaza City, one of our local partners approached us with a project where we were able to buy solar panels to get a well running in this refugee camp. So this was a camp actually where, again, most of the population had been forced to flee, but now there's about 7,000 families that have come back. They're living in their homes that are surrounded in rubble and partially damaged. But this well will provide, it's not water that's safe for them to drink, but it is good for hygiene and household use. So this we were just able to do last week. In addition to these kind of life-saving efforts, we've also been trying to continue as much as possible with our partners, other projects for children. So in the shelters, we've been running activities with some of our local partners. Again, they have teams of social workers who are trained. You know, Gaza's population has been deeply traumatized long before this latest attack. But of course, what children have seen and lived through in these last 5+ months is a whole nother level. So these trained social workers are able to go into the shelters and organize activities with the kids, try to provide them with some outlets to play and to talk about what they've experienced. So this is happening ongoing wherever we're able to reach the kids. In the beginning of the attack, we did provide right away, fuel was cut off and electricity was cut off. And so we were able to support three of our local partners with that operate hospitals, nonprofit hospitals in Gaza, with the funds to buy fuel supplies that kept them going when there was no electricity. Those reserves ran out long ago. We did not expect this attack to continue for months and months. But thankfully, these hospitals actually are all still, I don't know if you could call it operational. I don't know if you could call any hospital currently in Gaza operational. But they are open and receiving patients and providing as much care as they can. These are photos of, we bought mobile ICU units in Egypt in 2001. That is now working in Gaza. And we have another one that has been waiting at the border for more than a month now. So I think this gets back to, you know, the challenges of working in Gaza. You know, our staff and our local partners and our volunteers take extreme risk to go out and do this work. You know, there really is nowhere safe in Gaza. So for them to go out every day into the markets and to collect the aid, deliver the aid, is incredible. They're also doing this on roads that have been turned to rubble. You know, the main roads in Gaza, most of them are now blocked by the Israeli occupation forces. So a lot of you have to use back roads and they're filled with rubble. It's very difficult conditions for moving around. But since the only access points for aid coming in is in Rafah in the south, our staff in Rafah have been taking it upon themselves. You know, when we tried so many routes, we tried so many companies asking them, please, can you help us deliver this aid to our partners in other areas? And nobody would do it. And so our staff in Rafah got a truck and drove it to get the aid where it needed to go for families in the central Gaza who were not able to access anything that was coming in. This is also happening in the context, you know, where there are communications blackouts, you know, due to the damage to the telecommunications systems, the lack of electricity, the lack of fuel. You know, there are days that you can't make phone calls, you can't connect to the internet. And so people are going out there and doing this work. And we can't even check on them and make sure if they're okay. The telecommunications blackout is also why I am the one here speaking to you. I'm based in the West Bank, and I'm supporting our team in Gaza, but they are not able to have the internet connection to join and speak about what they are living through and what they are doing. And overall, you know, the siege of Gaza has meant that, you know, in February, we saw days where there were 4 trucks or 9 trucks coming in for a population of 2.3 million. You know, when the attacks began in October, the estimate was, you know, that 100 trucks a day were needed for the basic needs. Now, people in Gaza need everything. They need tents and warm clothes and blankets and things to cook with and food to cook and medicine and clean water. Everything is lacking in Gaza. And so at a bare minimum, what people need is 500 trucks a day. And we have not seen a single day where that amount of aid has come into Gaza. So this is really, you know, a deliberate, not just starvation, but a deliberate deprivation of all of the basic needs for the population in Gaza. And I think I will stop there.
Well, thank you so much, Josie. Really difficult to hear, and even more difficult, obviously, for those who are living through this, and so appreciate all of the efforts of the Middle East Children's Alliance, your work, and others. I would now like to introduce Awad Abbas, who is a communications and outreach coordinator for the Middle East Children's Alliance. She completed her master's in humanitarian action with a focus on statelessness and forced migration. Before joining MECCA, she worked with different local and international organizations, including Amnesty International, Save the Children, and the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. Wad, who is a mom, and she is in Palestinian territory. Her young children go to bed early, and she took the time today to send us by video her presentation. So let us go to her presentation now.
Thank you so much for giving me the space today to speak with you on International Women's Day, and for the amazing efforts to pull off this event and fundraiser, given the never-ending attempts at silencing those who speak up for Palestine and support Palestinians. This world has never been more absurd, dystopian, and terrifying. It is extremely difficult to speak today in a world where our words and their echoes are getting silenced, reduced, and pushed away. It is extremely difficult to use words to describe horrors that we cannot even begin to comprehend. It is extremely difficult today to speak when there are lumps in our throats that we continue to fight back as to not burst in tears and weep, or get completely and utterly paralyzed in the face of the cruel monstrosity we have been witnessing, and unable to stop due to the imperial and hegemonic powers that continue to dehumanize our existence and being on a daily basis. Tongue-tied. That is how I have felt for the past 6 months, every day, that my tongue is tied and that my words are stuck mid-sentence. But knowing how our voices matter, knowing how important it is to never stop speaking the truth, even when our voices shake and break, today I will do my best to share some of the stories of the amazing women, Palestinian women, who have affected me on a personal, individual level on the one hand, and touch the hearts and minds of us collectively as women in Palestine and elsewhere around the world on the other. Sumud Imter. Sumud means steadfastness, and so she was a self-fulfilling prophecy in a sense. Palestine was not a slogan or a symbol to her, it was what she breathed and lived for. Sumud was not just our colleague and partner at Stop the Wall Coalition, she was a true courageous organizer, whether behind the scene or on the front lines. Ahad Imter, her 22-year-old sister, who had a baby girl who wasn't even a year old yet, was killed by a cruel Israeli sniper on the 15th of January, 2024, as the Israeli military has conducted another deadly military incursion midday into our homes and towns. Sumud led her sister's funeral and carried her on her shoulders to honor her and take her to her last resting place, while screaming her name loud, clear, and proud. When we first saw her to offer our condolences, she said, "Ahad is not the first, nor will she be the last. And if we think that we are an exception to Israeli brutality, then we're not true fighters to the Israeli apartheid regime. I am heartbroken, I am angry, but I know that in our struggle for freedom, we will pay the price, the most precious price. And in this case, it was a piece of my heart, my sister." Sumud was arbitrarily detained at dawn on International Women's Day, and she's been sentenced to administrative detention, which means that the Israeli apartheid regime is holding her hostage into their cells without trial and based on secret evidence that neither her nor her lawyers will get access to, and this detention could be prolonged endlessly. Since October 7th, more than 7,000 Palestinians have been detained arbitrarily, making at least 9,000 Palestinians in Israeli dungeons. Of those, almost 3,500 are held arbitrarily under administrative detention. Israeli authorities have been leading a retaliation and punishment campaign against Palestinian prisoners and detainees since October 7th. Hence, even though we know Sumud will hold up to her name in their dungeons, we are terrified for her and the other 1,000 lives under this brutal regime. Diala Al-Ayesh. Diala Al-Ayesh was never just another Palestinian lawyer who worked only in courtrooms to advocate for human rights under the authoritarian Palestinian government, or to advocate for Palestinian prisoners and detainees in Israeli dungeons, the same dungeons she's currently imprisoned in. Diala was always present, whether during the Nizar Banat trials, or during protest and demonstrations, or during military raids and incursions, and following up when arbitrary arrests and human rights violations occurred in this protest and raid. She did most of her work pro bono and on a voluntary basis. She was always ready to respond with any question or provide legal support when anyone has reached out to her. She was arbitrarily detained at a checkpoint near Beit Lahem on the 17th of January 2024 as she was on her way back from Ahad Imter's funeral, so she could be the supportive friend that she was to Sumud after the brutal killing of her sister. Diala Allah has taught us all how it is always important to be a human before anything else. She was always strong and steadfast in the face of injustice, never apologetic, and always vocal. And until she regains her freedom, we will continue to follow her path. Sanaa Salameh. Sanaa Salameh is a Palestinian lawyer and advocate for Palestinian prisoners and detainees. And that's how she met the love of her life, Waleed Daqqa, as she was doing voluntary work related to Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons. The Israeli apartheid regime has been nothing but cruel and racist to her and her family. They denied her the right to be with the love of her life even after he finished his sentence in Israeli prisons and was supposed to be released last year. They denied him the right to have children, to which they had to smuggle her husband's sperm outside of prison so they are able to have a chance at having a family where they had the baby girl, Milad. And now, as Waleed is chronically ill without much time longer, given the gravity of his illness, the Israeli authorities are also denying him the right to spend his remaining years with his wife and child. Amid all of this, Sanaa has never stopped advocating for Waleed and the rest of Palestinian prisoners despite the repression, despite the racism, and despite all this cruelty. Shuruq al-Aile. Shuruq did not ask to be an inspiration, yet she ended up being one. Shuruq had witnessed losing her husband, Rushdie Sarraj, right in front of her eyes as their home was bombed by Israeli forces back in October 2023. Rushdie was the co-founder of Ain Media, and he's been losing his colleagues one after the other over the past 6 years, whether they were targeted by Israeli bullets, bombs, or arbitrary detentions, until his own life was taken by the same perpetrators on the 22nd of October 2023. Yet despite the pain, the displacement, and all of this unfathomable loss, Shuruq decided to not let Ain Media fade away under the rubble as well, and has decided to get the production company back to work to document the current horrors to show the world what is really happening, just like her husband did. And the list of amazing women that I could share with the tiniest of glimpses into their daily struggles for freedom, justice, and accountability will go on and on. I could take days on end to tell you about Salam Hassan, the calm but fierce advocate for Palestine, who had to witness her fiancé being detained and tortured, only for her to face the same fate after they were married, and now once again as her husband has been detained yet again. I could tell you about Mam al-Kharouf, the full of life Palestinian from Jerusalem, who continues to hold on to her right to love and family amid a system that is designed to take these away from her, as she and her husband continue to battle the draconian Israeli system to get her husband his residency rights, as he's been denied these rights his entire adult life until this very day. I could tell you about my colleague Wafa Dirawi, who is still working day and night to provide the necessary support to our people during these horrifying times. And I could tell you about Fatima Nawaja from the Ruler Women Association in Sousia, who's dealing with state-backed settler violence and oppression on a regular basis, where she and her community continue to hold their ground amid yet another reprisal campaign. I could tell you about my maternal grandmother, Umm Mahmoud, who lost her oldest son back in 1976 as he was killed by an Israeli sniper as he was participating in a protest against Israeli policies, and how until the day she passed away, she recalled the day of his murder as it has happened yesterday. I could tell you about my paternal grandmother, Umm Ghassan, who has always taught me to equip myself with knowledge and to always hold my ground. Every time that she was stopped by an Israeli soldier in the old city of Jerusalem and was asked for her ID and where is she from, as they usually ask you before letting anyone across their checkpoints, she'd push ahead and she says, "I am from here. Where are you from?" to always remind them that we have roots here and that they are the strangers, not the other way around. And these are some of the women that I know. We have millions of the other faceless and nameless women across all of historical Palestine that continue to face this gruesome, racist, and monstrous regime. The amazing women who still hold on to their humanity in front of this ruthless machinery that insists on turning us into the monsters of the system that they represent, but fail every single time because we come from love. Love to our women, love to our men, love to our land, and love to justice and freedom. I could give you statistics on the brutalities that Palestinian women are currently facing, wherever they were, but especially in Gaza as they face the grand Israeli genocide and apartheid. I could tell you that more than 9,000 women were killed in the occupied Gaza since October 7th alone. I could tell you that nearly 1 million women and girls are currently displaced, living in beyond dire conditions. I could tell you that more than 3,000 women have become widows, and that on average, 63 women in Gaza are killed daily by Israeli soldiers through American, British, French, and German weapons. I could tell you that women in Gaza are having C-sections without anesthesia and are battling starvation on a daily basis to keep themselves and their children alive. If they are lucky enough to not get killed by an Israeli bombing or sniper bullets or aid box being dropped on their heads with no parachute opening or infectious disease spreading, or that they survive torture, including sexual violence at Israeli detention, and the list of horrifying crimes goes on and on and on. I could keep sharing and telling you about all of these struggles, not just that Palestinian women are going through, but all women, from Sudan to Syria to Congo to Chile to Iraq to Colombia to Egypt to Yemen, and the list goes on. And we should continue to share all of these stories and beyond. But most importantly, we should continue to disrupt any sense of normal life, because there is no normal life when genocide is unfolding in front of us, when apartheid has been slowly killing Palestinians for the past 75 years and beyond, and when military occupation only enables all of this, and when settler colonialism paved the way for this annihilation campaign against Palestinians wherever we were. Let us never be quiet. Let us not go gently into the night, and let us continue disrupting, organizing, and screaming our lungs out for a free Palestine and for accountability to take place, because no one is free until we are all free. And finally, allow me to end this with the words beautifully sung by Alaa Salah 4 years ago as protests have erupted in Sudan, where she said, the bullet does not kill, but being silent will. So be loud in every way possible until the oppressor's noise ceases to silence voices asking for justice and accountability, and then only songs of freedom are sung. Thank you so much for your time.
We're going to take a short station break. When we return, we'll continue hearing the voices of Palestinian women. I would now like to introduce our next speaker. I would like to introduce Samia Shoman, a California native with Palestinian roots. She has dedicated her career in public education to promoting racial and social justice in the classroom and broader educational organization she has worked in. She is also the co-coordinator of the Middle East Children's Alliance Teach Palestine Project. Samia, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. You know, I was asked to discuss the impact of the Gaza genocide on women and children in the United States. And I feel like so much of what I have to say echoes what my sister Wa'ed shared. And, you know, I felt so emotional seeing her on the screen, and Josie as well. I was with them 3 years ago in Palestine, and to be brought together under these circumstances is hard. You know, I feel like being asked to describe the impact is being asked to describe my daily life. I'm a mother to 13-year-old twins. I saw something online that I feel like really explains the depths of our despair. It was by someone named Mark Lemon, and he posted, "You don't survive grief, you learn how to wear it, how to move forward with it by your side throughout your life. Time isn't the fix to pain, but it can teach you how to grow with it. We all carry an inner strength to move forward, even when we don't want to." And that's what it's like every day when you wake up and people are questioning, the media is questioning your value as a full human being. So I'm going to speak a little bit about my own experience. And I know it's the experience of countless others. A lot of my friends that I have reconnected with, Palestinian, you know, mothers, my own siblings and my sisters, who talk about what's happening, you know, to think about where, you know, celebrating and trying to acknowledge International Women's Day. But unless you are a woman advocating for justice in Gaza and all of the places that I'd mentioned, you know, you can't really celebrate or acknowledge the day. We have to recognize and continue to recognize and uplift the indiscriminate suffering and injustice that's being inflicted on Palestinian women and young girls. And at the same time, we can't forget their strength and courage amidst the horrors of what's happening. I know, right, as a mother, as a parent, we do anything we can. We will go to the ends of the earth to protect our children. So it's not normal watching what we're watching. And I know from people who have recently returned or gotten out of Gaza that what we're seeing, even on social media, is nothing compared to the reality on the ground. So imagine the horror that we feel like we're seeing, but actually experiencing it. So I think kind of the best way I can describe our experience is that we have begun to and will forever contextualize everything we do and everything we say. I work as an educator, right? I'm a mom, I'm Palestinian. And I think you no longer say, "I'm hungry." I feel like sometimes my kids start to say it and then they take it back. The secondary trauma and the survivor's guilt is very real. Sometimes I will be driving and start imagining horrible things that could potentially be happening to my kids. And then I think, "Oh my God, why am I thinking this way? I've never thought that way." You feel like nothing you are doing is enough. And you don't know. You don't know how to keep going, but we do. So it's like you're trying to live this kind of normal life and feeling like you're in the depths of despair, and then having to check yourself that, like, why should you even feel like this when you're living in this world with all of the privilege? Women don't even have menstrual pads, and we can just go to the grocery store, right? I have a home and a roof over my head. So I think some of the things that we try to deal with is we sit in the school board meetings where people are on the attack. We see ourselves being targeted, being doxxed, being disinvited from speaking engagements, worrying about our children and what kind of bullying they might face. And when we speak up about that, it seems to be exceptionalized. So you're constantly having to defend something that should never have to be defended. We have to console our kids. We have to remind our kids. And I wonder, you know, if their hearts are still whole. I've noticed a pattern, right, at home, and I know it's the same for others. We eat less. We don't complain. We don't feel like our lives are hard, even if, you know, there are those challenging days. And we just remember that no matter what what's happening kind of in our lives, and when you feel like you're being drowned out and you feel like the messages are going out from schools, from city councils who aren't acknowledging your existence, that the people with the real courage are the ones that are at home in Palestine. And all you can do is try to hope that people will listen to you with an open heart because you know that there's others that are trying to, you know, belittle or deny our humanity. So we continue to present, to write, to make sure that these policies cannot exclude us. I mean, for me, education is my area of expertise. So I've spent a lot of time with parents asking, like, hey, this happened at school. What should I do? This is what's being sent out. What should I do? We're finding our circles, right, where we don't have to explain ourselves, where it's a mere look of acknowledgement and understanding. You know, we're finding our non-Palestinian allies who understand. You know, kind of, I say we're finding our Yemens in our life. And honestly, our circles have gotten smaller. It's hard to see people going on with their normal lives when you have to go to work or you're expected to go to work. People are sitting around having these normal conversations, even in the classrooms. And all you want to do as a person is say, like, please stop. There's a genocide going on. Can we talk about this? Can you just recognize, right, how we are walking through our days? I run a school, and in my school we have a philosophy. It's grounded in a poem by Luis Valdez in the area. It's called In Lakesh. And there's one line of the poem, and it's Tu eres mi otro yo in Spanish. And it translates into You are my other me. So I'd encourage people just to hold on to that, that the mothers in Gaza, they are us. The children, the families, they are us. We have to act in that way. It's our moral obligation. If you don't feel like it's your, then it's our civic obligation. It's our human obligation. Because we are walking around in silence, holding our screams inside, and then wanting to apologize because we feel like we've been failures up to this point. In U.S. schools, we talk about ACEs or the impact, you know, it's a number that trauma has on students. And we know that research shows trauma impacts students social, emotionally, their learning. We've talked about, right, the trauma of COVID-19 and how much it is. And I think about that, and I think, God, you know, if we could go back to thinking about what a privilege it was to be locked up with our families. When I think about the orphan kids in Gaza, our ability to stay safe and make a decision about whether we wanted to go out or not. And I am not trying to lessen that COVID didn't really impact young people. I'm just wondering why that same conversation isn't being had in schools around how what's happening in Gaza is impacting students and my kids and my own kids. You know, there's a new classification, wounded child, no surviving family. And I think it's important for us to recognize the wounded means physically, it means emotionally, it means psychologically. And I know, and I'm proud to be part of an organization like Mecca, who is addressing all three of those. And so lastly, you know, I wonder, as much as my children and I talk about and look at what's happening, and they're watching, they're on TikTok, and, you know, what is going on in their brains and in their hearts and their souls, and how do they navigate their days? Normal, we will never go back to normal. Like, our life here, just like the people back home, have changed in a way that I think is unexplainable. And we're constantly looking for what can we do? What should we do? We're not doing enough. I know that I have found protests as an outlet for our rage as we're screaming in the streets. But I hope the people in Gaza know we are, you know, we're trying. We're going to continue to try. I see all of these, you know, people on this webinar and people who are giving. And so I would say, you know, we all kind of have to continue to do what we can and to educate others and spend time with people who are open to listening and to learning and to uplift, you know, Gaza and all of the other problems like it that are happening in this world.
Thank you so much. I want to make sure that we thank our tech team, Rosanna Cambron, Eric Jertson from Payday Men's Network, Nell Myhan with Women of Color Global Women's Strike, as well as one of the joint coordinators of California Poor People's Campaign. We want to thank Nancy Berlin. also part of the GWS network. She's with Alexandria House, always a big support, Alexandria House, and she's also a joint coordinator with the Poor People's Campaign. We want to thank all of our speakers, and we also want to thank Claire Archarlo with the Indigenous Environmental Network, who did the opening for us. And we want to thank also our Spanish language interpreters. And I want to lift up La Resencia, Maru, who helped put us in touch with them. We also want to thank Katia Stitt, who is the program director of the Pacifica Station, WPFW in DC, who pulled together the slides that you saw at the beginning of it, and also helped us to be in touch with Barbara Hunt, our marvelous ALS interpreter. We want to thank the whole of the Global Women's Strike team. We have to mention Selma James, who is our coordinator internationally. Also, Nina Lopez, they're both based in London, England. I can tell you, our sisters in London, they have been on the streets, it seems to me, nearly just about every day. And Sam, the Jewish members, Rachel West, you know, so I want to lift up Movement for Family Power for the incredible work that they did with our graphics and our social media kit and with this particular fundraiser. And Josie and all of you, and you all stay well and safe. And please take action, get out on the street, stay well and safe. Thank you. I'd like to thank Jose Benavides for his help with today's show. Special thanks to the Middle East Children's Alliance. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. Go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for more programming on your local station. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air next Tuesday. Y'all, please stay well and safe. This is your host, Margaret Preston.